And welcome, beloved listeners, to LNL. A long time ago, early in my 23-year tenure, I had a couple of producers who were absolutely besotted with Jung, and the program was subject to a Jungian takeover. Finally, I put the foot down and declared this to be a Jung-free zone, but I have to apologize to Carl because tonight there are two extraordinary examples of his synchronicity. I've just been eavesdropping on my first guest, Peter Jukes, who will be joining us in a second to discuss Rebecca Brooks, and he just met the second guest outside the London studio, namely Sarah Churchwell, with whom I'll be discussing The Great Gatsby. Turns out they're very, very old friends and had a rapturous reunion, but that's only one aspect of synchronicity tonight. The other is that driving up through the dark from Sydney to the farm last night, I was listening, as I always do, to a recorded novel. And in this case, it was The Great Gatsby. And I had no idea that I'd be talking to Sarah about that extraordinary novel tonight. So, Carl, if you're listening, you have my abject apologies. There's another example of synchronicity, I guess, in that both our stories tonight, that involving Rebecca Brooks and Rupert, and that involving F. Scott Fitzgerald and Gatsby, are about the high life. Now, my next guest, Peter Jukes, watched the trial of Rebecca every single day for 8 months, and by the time the trial had finished, he had tweeted 500,000 words and had an immense number of followers. Now, that live tweeter has put his mind to finding out what the tabloid queen will do next. Full-time motherhood to a two-year-old daughter, Scarlett, is an option, and internal sources at the House of Murdoch say that there is a possibility of a senior position in News Corp Australia. And yes, we've raised that possibility previously. Peter has been named Britain's best social media journalist for covering the longest-running criminal trial in British history, and he's now written a book about the behind-the-scenes legal battles and personal dramas which were the subject of reporting restrictions during the trial. The author of Beyond Contempt, the inside story of the phone hacking trial, joins the Little Wireless program from, yes, our London studio. Welcome to a program swirling with synchronicity.
Indeed, is there a connection, Philip? Careless people, which is the line from The Great Gatsby, isn't it?
Though it is indeed.
I wouldn't say Rebecca Brooks was careless. In fact, quite the opposite, a very, very careful, engaged, almost mesmerizing personality. And I think, you know, to some extent, long trial syndrome, it's called. She mesmerized the jury.
Now, do you think Rupert may be looking at employing her again, whether it's thither or yon? Would he really risk the blowback?
Two elements to this. My answer, simple answer, that would be boring and short for you, is no. But just to elaborate a little bit, let's go for the more sort of corporate side first. This did not solve Rupert Murdoch's problems in corporate charges terms, which are still pending here, and obviously related ones in the US. The fact that a senior executive was found not guilty, and those beneath her were, who had autonomy, i.e. desk heads and her deputy at News of the World, Andy Coulson, and then editor at News of the World, actually doesn't solve the problem corporately, because who sanctioned this? If the chief executive doesn't, is the corporation itself to blame. And part of Brooks's defense was from her barrister, Jonathan Lady, or QC, and his summing up, well, she failed in 2006 and 2009 in exposing the phone hacking, the further phone hacking. And though it's not a crime, she failed. She was part of a cover-up, as the judge called it. So on that side, that doesn't solve any problems for News Corp in general. And that means taking it back into the fold is, you know, not good. But more interestingly, and I've had this confirmed now from the journalist in question, the Independent reported, I think 2 days ago, that actually, missing two sources in News Corp, Murdoch was furious when he heard about the affair. The affair first came to light in legal arguments about a year ago, and actually longer, about 14 months ago. And he is reported to have said, words to the effect, she'll never work for me again. I think this is a case of, rather than sort of, you know, a triangle or any sort of jealousy in that way, that he expects his editors to be, you know, when they're criticizing other people's sex lives, to, you know, show some on themselves, and also a clash of loyalties. She was managing that situation with a burgeoning scandal from 2009 till 2011 when it broke. And if she was very close to Coulson, how could he, you know, closer to him than she was to Rupert, how could he have trusted the information that came out so devastatingly in July 2011?
I don't believe that any journalist should have a sex life, Peter. And in fact, when you were employed by the ABC here, you renounce
monastic. I can feel that. I'm in the room. I feel like sort of, I don't know, maybe, you know, whipping myself or something.
Well, you may wish to genuflect.
I may.
This is the naughty Peter Jukes, journalist, author, screenwriter, playwright, literary critic, and yes, now. Infamous blogger. Do you think she'll be happy going back to the Cotswolds, to the life of a farmer?
It's funny, isn't it? I mean, I knew her before, very briefly, before the trial, and got to see her every day for 8 months. Though it's very stressful for her, and you can see bad days, and, you know, I wished her happy birthday about 2 months ago. She said, well, I could think of better places to spend it. But I think she followed my tweets assiduously, I know, when she wasn't in court. She liked telling her story. She's a storyteller. You know, people say, who made this case happen? Who created this brilliant defense? I'm sure lawyers and PR advisors were involved. But who was Queen of Fleet Street for 10 to 15 years? Who knew exactly how to target a kind of populist audience? Her. And so she could retire to rural, you know, bucolic bliss with her daughter, maybe have another one in the Oxfordshire countryside. But, oh, what a falling off is there.
In parenthesis, I learned from you, and I didn't know this, that daughter Scarlett was born to a surrogate mother.
To her cousin, actually, yes. I mean, the evidence she gave in court was that met Charlie, he said, well, I want kids, even if, you know, you had difficulties having them with the famous actor Ross Kemp. And then her mother met her cousin in Warrington and explained Rebecca's problems, and the cousin stepped forward to become the surrogate mother. This, I'm sure it's coincidence, was around April 2011 when Brooks first suspected she might be arrested.
Mm. Now, Charlie, of course, can return to horse training and pornography, but, well, you know, these are two innocent pleasures, though.
Absolutely. And legal.
But they're not actually short of a quid, are they, Peter?
Well, Charlie is independently wealthy. He has kind of went to Eton, quite an aristocratic, I suppose, though, you know, chancellor background. But he's quite well, you know, it's a big farm there they have with three or four properties and lots of land. She had a £16 million payout from Murdoch. I don't know what that is in Australian dollars. I should do, because my son's in Melbourne. And she, you know, she also might have spent a lot of that on lawyers. She could do a book deal. I don't think it's money. I think after a certain point, and I think this with, you know, Rupert Murdoch in the kind of profile of, it's more than about money. You know, there's lots of rich bankers who don't want to be on TV or don't want to own newspapers. It's about influence, about story. And I think she'll miss being a friend of three successive prime ministers, all who hated each other, Brown, Blair and Cameron. She was friends with all of them.
But we live in a celebrity culture, and however celebrity is attained or obtained, it is a very powerful commodity. She could easily, could she not, start her own media company?
Oh, I think you're, Philip, I think that's, you're right, completely right, about the kind of celebrity-obsessed culture post-Princess Diana, which Brooks did so much to create, and Coulson, Andy Coulson, who's gone to prison, you know, with Piers Morgan. He came from the celebrity showbiz end of the business. And they added in trial, it was a great moment, actually, because one of the defense lawyers said during the trial that about how News of the World had won an award for the scoop of the year. 2003, I think it was, maybe David Beckham having an affair. And he said, of course, those days have gone now. You wouldn't give Scoop of the Year award to kiss and tell about a footballer having sex. I mean, you know, what's news there? And I think other things here, the conviction of Max Clifford, you know, he's the great PR guru who sold a lot of these stories, him for sexual offences. The recent, the fake shake, we have this famous investigator called the fake shake who's recently criticised in court for lying over one of his stings, and the case was thrown out against a singer, and he might face questions about his other cases. I think that celebrity culture, that culture of kiss and tells, is dying, and everybody's famous on Twitter.
So there has been a significant change in the style, the atmosphere of British newspapers, not just Murdoch's.
The Sun is a very different beast. I mean, Masmah Mahood did this sting was last year in the Sun on Sunday. They probably won't be using his services again in a hurry. And even the Sun, it hasn't dropped its famous topless page three, but it's more muted. It's less raucous, entitled kind of tabloid culture. I mean, the Mail, which I had a recent brush with, the Mail still continues on its line of kind of occasional politics of personal destruction. But my feeling is, their circulations are going down, and social media means that the audience can answer back and share their disapproval of these tactics. You know, more people listen to the radio program in the morning, Today program on BBC, than buy national newspapers. So maybe their day is fading.
How many followers have you accumulated, Peter?
Well, it's 12,000. But what I do notice, it's only because I cover the trial, is that there's a lot more who are not registered following me. I know all the defendants were following me. I know most of the lawyers were. I know most of the police were during the trial. So I think that's the registered number. Depending on what's happening, that could often be a lot more. And when I tweet out a link, I notice like 3 people retweet it, but like, you know, 50 people go there.
Let me introduce another character to our extraordinary drama. Someone called Tony Blair. I understand from you that during the trial he offered to act as Rebecca's unofficial biographer. I would have thought he would have been a bit busy filling that role for Wendy.
I don't think... Well, that was a very interesting sequence of evidence because as I write in my book, Beyond Contempt, without that being a plug, just being truthful, I've just been writing that section now. There was an email which Brecca Book sent to James Murdoch saying her long discussion with Tony Blair for an hour. This was just the day that News of the World closed and the Millie Dowler story had come out. And what he advised her to do, set up a Hutton report, which would clear her, which is an interesting analogy. Her words, by the way, not Tony Blair's. And also he'd offered to be an unofficial advisor, not biographer, to Rupert and James. Now, at first, the defense didn't want that document in at all, and they agreed with the prosecution to redact its essence. And at the last moment, his defense said, no, put it all out in the public domain. And I think that was part of the, let's say, a slightly less than gleeful attitude to Tony Blair after the revelations of his friendship with Wendy Deng.
Hello, RN, and we're discussing the next chapter of Rebecca Brook's life with author Peter Jukes. His new book is entitled Beyond Contempt, the inside story of the phone hacking trial. And you and Rebecca might have been a number, of course, yourselves, because let's discuss your first meeting with her at a literary festival.
Indeed, that has been misinterpreted, but we did get on very well. She, and you know, this is amazing because I was nobody. I'm still really nobody. I like being nobody. I like being an anonymous writer. But she was very. Her first lines to me were, "Everybody hates me," because it was run in those days by the Guardian, and I felt very protective towards her. And immediately, and this is in the book as well, because a very similar anecdote was related by a witness, Emma Cook. Immediately, she started telling me a lot about her private life. And so by the end, which was very endearing, and I automatically liked her. It wasn't feeling that way towards her. But I think by the end of the evening, we probably, I might have an arm around her in a comforting way. And to her assistant noticed a photographer was snapping away. It's a small late night party about 2 a.m. And so she walked up. This is the real power, by the way. She walked up to this photographer and she said to me, "Ross will kill you." I think she was just breaking up with Ross Kemp at the time, and talked to this photographer and came back in about a minute, and she had his whole memory card for the whole day. And I said, "What did you say to him? You give me that and you'll never have to worry about work again, or don't give me that and you'll never work again." And I suspect she wouldn't answer, but one of those two. And that was her power. She had the power of invisibility because she was, you know, one of the most powerful people in the media.
I love that line, everyone hates me. Here's your book called Beyond Contempt. Shortly, Sarah comes on with her Careless People. But Everyone Hates Me would be a wonderful title for an autobiography.
It would be. I hope it's not mine. I hope it's not yours, Philip. It's such a brilliant term. It's what she did, I think, in her defense so brilliantly, which worked with the jury, you know, was... to just present, and I think it is partly her, don't get me wrong, I don't think it was a complete fiction, it might have airbrushed out certain elements of her character, present this person who was campaigning, very open, very direct, who was then a victim of a kind of witch hunt. And it's very beguiling. It's completely wrong foot to people, completely wrong foot from what I heard, all the senior News Corp executives in New York. And it's, she's a character from some great novel. I mean, she's almost, I think, like, as I put in the book just now, Scarlett O'Hara, but taken from the antebellum South to Whopping in the Blairite era. There's something, Gone with the Wind about.
Well, even the name Scarlett comes to mind. I mean, it's...
Exactly.
Very interesting, isn't it?
Yeah. Iconic. Almost Jungian, though I mentioned it.
I understand that tweeting involves a lot of use of the thumbs. Have your thumbs become vast, like the cheeks of a glass blower?
Oh, that's interesting. I've never seen glass blower's thumbs, and I must look at
no,
them.
No, cheeks.
Cheeks. Oh, cheeks. Oh, the cheeks of the face. Gosh, those cheeks in the face. No. I mean, I do use more than just my thumbs. I use all fingers, if possible, for that very reason. Also, you have to be quick, And you have to redact all the names before they jump on you for contempt of court.
450,000 words, 2.5 million keystrokes. I've been bullied into tweeting by the ABC, and I find it almost impossible to get to work within that the limit.
You're a bit of a poet, aren't you, Philip? You've got a sense of poetry. I've noticed some poetry on the program. Think in terms of a stanza or a couplet. That was, I think, my background in drama really helped me, because it's not quite to be or not to be the two lines of iambic pentameter, but it is a quatrain. It's a quatrain. You can get 140 characters, four lines of a six-syllable poem, or six-word poem.
I imagine your social circle is widening by orders of magnitude. What about Rebecca's? Here was someone who was the hub of an entire cosmology. That's a mixed metaphor, and I wish I hadn't said it, but what I'm getting at.
Why not hubs and cosmologies? How do we know the universe isn't based around a huge hub at the center of it?
It may well be. I must make inquiries, but is she now sort of... unacceptable socially? I would have thought that, the gravitational pull, another cosmological reference, of celebrity would be making her even more popular. She got off the, she won the case.
Well, this is very, very interesting. I would have thought that. Now, just so you don't get me wrong, I was always very open-minded whether she'd be guilty or not at the burden of proof of a criminal charge. And actually, I wasn't so interested in journalists going to jail as disclosure, what really went on, and we got a lot of that. But I was, after the not guilty verdict on all those four counts, I went to Chipping Norton, the famous Chipping Norton set nearby. They have a festival called the Cornbury Festival in Great Tew, this lovely Oxfordshire village, where she usually is at. Actually, the last few years, I saw last year there smoking with Jeremy Clarkson. She wasn't there. And I went to the house of the big party, mainly because a friend of mine is a publisher and lives there, I'm not at all posh myself. And everyone was saying, where's Rebecca? And I'm just quoting, I put no judgment on, how did she get away with it? So, if that's the court of public opinion, it's not, they don't know, they didn't see the evidence, the jury did. But there is a slight sense, I have not heard one person say, why were those charges brought, what was going on with the police? They're going, wow, there just wasn't the evidence there. Or, O.J. Simpson, she got away with it. Now, okay. That's their judgment. I don't agree. I saw the evidence, and I could see completely why she was found not guilty, just because there's an absence of evidence there.
Peter, Beyond Contempt is said to contain all the action the media was legally barred from publishing. Yeah. What were some of the reporting restrictions that you faced and that the media in general faced?
Oh, my goodness. I mean, here's an example. Every morning, a defense barrister would turn up and say, my lord, there's been a tweet. and basically, Brooks's defense was, as a kind of backup defense, for appeal or whatever, that she could not get a fair trial given all the prejudicial coverage of her leading up to the trial. So that was right from day one, the motion to dismiss the case. And so they were all over the media, all over my timeline, every little tweet, they were watching. So you had that element of that they were looking for anything which was prejudgmental. But then, on top of that, you had, because there's 12 related trials, every other mention of any potential defendant in any other trial or somebody being arrested could not be mentioned at all. And so live tweeting, a nightmare, especially Dan Evans, who's just been sentenced today, who's a cooperating witness with the police, News of the World journalist, who admitted to hacking. He's got 10 months of a suspended sentence. In his evidence, there were 20 names you couldn't mention. apart from, you know, various other names, like I mentioned, even now, there's still restrictions. So that was the problem. So many other trials and a media and media organizations and lawyers, the most expensive trial in defense terms ever, millions and millions, watching you like a hawk, going, oh, look, look, you're content. So I wouldn't recommend it. It's like walking through a minefield wearing flip-flops.
I'm like that. Could you twig that immediately? Citizen journalist and media pioneer. You're on the cutting edge, young man.
I love the word young. I won't give away my real age, but keep it up. I'll stay forever.
But it is a transformational moment, isn't it? This trial has, in some ways, been, next to certain events in the Middle East, has been the great, provided the great momentum for tweeting.
I think that too, and, the idea that you can, you know, go in there, you have your own Australian broadcast company, you know, if you're out on Twitter, that could be retweeted millions of times. I think, and the capacity of people to answer back. I mean, people funded me, crowdfunded me, I think, because I thought, oh, I hope I had to be legally impartial, and that I wasn't part of a media organization, either BBC or News International, or News UK. But I think what amazing going on in Ukraine, because, you know, I'm sure you'd be following it, the stuff about the launch, shooting down the jet that the separatists claimed on Facebook that they'd shot at a Ukrainian cargo plane and then deleted it. It's social media is also a great place to research stories.
Now, I've known Rupert Murdoch for half a century, and I have to say, he's not really from Australia. This is a mistake. He is from a distant planet.
Scotland.
No, from outer space.
Right.
And he really, this is true. I've never divulged it before. And this explains why he's never going to die. And why nothing stops him, because while we're sitting here discussing the events in London, here he is making a power grab for Time Warner. Does that not take your breath away?
Oh, amazing, isn't he? Every time he doubles down. But, he's transformational. I mean, he is an American citizen now, isn't he? Having declared his loyalty to Australia, rapidly became an American citizen. There's that mixture of principle and business expediency, which means... But I mean, my criticism, I have no personal gripe against the man. I have a gripe against countries like my own, and let alone yours, who allowed any kind of monopoly to develop in any media. And this is not a leftish liberal argument. This is a free market right-wing argument. Never let monopolies develop, because power will end up being abused. And it may be in the generation after Murdoch. Once people get that power, that, you know, they can set the market, they can set the rate, they can set the agenda as News of the World did.
Talking about setting the market, I would assume that there's any number of producers, series producers, film producers, after the Brooke story.
Probably. I mean, I've heard so many rumors for the last 3 years about, you know, films about it. Who's going to play Hugh Grant? Is Hugh Grant going to play Hugh Grant? You know, all those kind of jokes. I don't know. It's such... I read a previous book called The Fall of House of Murdoch, which I stand by. The house, the dynasty, is in problems. They maybe bounce back. Is that it's not actually a film. It's a 7-season, 13-episode American series like The Sopranos. I mean, by the way, it's not saying anything like gangsters. I'm just saying of that ilk.
Oh, you said it. You've said it. You've been very naughty again. Look, Peter, thank you very much. You've been a tonic. Journalist, screenwriter, playwright, literary critic, blogger, Peter Jukes. New book, Beyond Contempt, The Inside Story of the Phone Hacking Trial, published by Canberra Press at the end of the month. And a little bit of music while we swap chairs in our London studios to accommodate Peter's friend and my next guest, Sarah Churchwell.